that was the second and last time.
Okay, so let's get started here. I hope that most of you have gotten started with the programming assignment. Again, I would like to encourage you to not wait until the last minute. This one involves not only C++ but also pthreads and synchronization, which can be very easy to trip over if you don't use the right synchronization primitives or the right code. You will have race conditions and all sorts of problems. So it's very important to leave enough time for debugging. Okay, so don't expect that the program is going to work at the first attempt. So do get started soon. Some of you have sent questions and we have been trying to address them, and I will keep replying. Either I or Sashi will get back to you if you have questions. We have office hours, you can come talk to us. We can't debug every line of your code, but at the same time we would like to help you as much as we can. Okay, so we'll try what we can do. I made an announcement last time about the midterm. Okay, so just wanted to remind everyone, October 28th, Tuesday, in this same room, but an evening exam. Okay, closed book, closed notes. Okay, I will sometime next week I will hand out a sample exam, so you know exactly what kind of questions to expect. I'm also going to do a review to explain what material will be on the test, what kinds of questions to expect, and so on. So you will have plenty of time to prepare. Okay, so watch out for that. Now, just to continue where we left off last time. So we talked about monitors, and I also presented two or three canonical synchronization problems, namely the readers writers problem, the dining philosophers problems, and in the class before that I had talked about the producer consumer problem. So last time there was a question about what are some real world applications where these problems are actually relevant, and I promised to come back with some real world examples. So here is basically a glimpse of where one might use some of these ideas. Okay, so they are fairly prevalent, but here are some examples. So if you go back to the producer consumer problem, okay, so producer consumer is where you have a shared buffer. The producer is producing data and the consumer is consuming data. Okay, any audio video player is an example of this kind of problem. So suppose you're streaming audio or video over a network. Okay, your video or audio player, okay, is going to be a multi-threaded application. There will be one thread that is reading data as it's arriving on the network. Okay, so suppose you are just streaming from a server or doing a webcast. Okay, so there's one thread that is going to just read off the network and put this data into a shared buffer. Okay, and then there's another thread that is actually going to pull data off the shared buffer, process it and render on the screen, for example. Okay, or if it's audio, put it on a sound card. So the shared buffer is being shared by, in this case, the producer is the network thread. It's actually pulling data and putting it into the buffer, and the consumer is the thread that processes and renders this data. Okay, there are other examples, like web servers use the same architecture. Okay, when you send a request to a web server, what happens is typical web servers are multi-threaded. There's a master thread that is just grabbing all the requests that are coming over a network. Okay, so there may be lots of concurrent users for this website. So there are lots of requests for HTTP requests coming over a network. So they are all pulled by this master thread, okay, and they will put it into a task queue. Okay, so this task queue is a shared buffer, and there are a pool of worker threads. Okay? Each worker thread then pulls off a request from the queue and processes that request. So this could be HTTP request to get a page or a HTML page or a GIF image or whatever it is. Okay, so there is a task queue. The master is putting stuff into this task queue as requests are arriving over a network. A worker thread just pulls it off and processes it and sends back a response back to the browser. Okay, another example of producers and consumers. Okay, reader-writer problem is the other problem we looked at. So here you have again a shared data structure that is shared between two types of threads, okay, reader threads and writer threads. Reader threads only read this data structure, don't modify it, and writer threads modify the data structure. Okay. Examples of this may be a banking system. Okay, so assume that this banking system has your bank account. Now there are many types of operations on this bank account. You may go to an ATM and just look up your account balance. Okay? That's a read operation on this shared database. Okay? Or you may deposit some money into an ATM, or you may walk into a bank branch and actually do a teller transaction. Okay? And at the end of the month, if you have or are lucky enough to have a bank that actually pays you interest on your checking account, there may be a batch job that runs, that looks up all the account balances and adds an interest to that account. Okay? So some of these tasks are modifying the shared database. Some others are reading. If you're just doing account balance lookup, okay, it's just going to read but not write. So here's a good example where you need both read locks and write locks. Okay, you want to maximize concurrency. So if there are concurrent read operations on this account database, then you should allow them all to proceed in parallel. Okay. But if there are updates to your database, then you need to get a write lock. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So dining philosophers was the last problem I talked about. And this was the inspiration for this comes from what are called cooperating processes that need to share limited resources. Okay? So this is a generic problem. Okay, I'll talk about specific example, but the generic problem arises because there are more tasks or processes than there are resources. Okay? And in this case, specifically, each process or a thread needs access to multiple resources, not one. Okay? So in the case of dining philosophers, you needed the left chopstick and the right chopstick. So you needed access to two resources. But the generalization of this problem is one where you need access to some number of resources, not just one. So you need to grab multiple locks before you can do something. Okay? And that's the synchronization problem. So there are several real world examples. So I'm going to talk about one in the context of operating system and one that's more general. Okay? So think of processes that are running on a system. So there may be a backup process. Okay, this is making backup of the data. Okay, it may need to grab both the disk as well as the tape. These are two resources at the same time, and is reading all the files from disk and is dumping it to the tape. Okay, and you might want to do this and ensure that files are not changing while you are doing the backup. For example, so you might grab a temporary lock both on the disk and the tape. Okay, now there may be another process that may need access to the disk and something else, okay, like let's say graphics card. So it may be streamed reading from the disk and writing to a graphics card. And there may be yet another process that needs access to, let's say, the disk and the printer. Just as an example, is reading and writing to the printer. And if you need mutually exclusive access to multiple resources, then you need to grab locks on these resources both at the same time. Okay. And the dining philosopher's problem is just a cute way of representing this more general problem where there are some number of processes that are sharing some number of resources. The number of processes is greater than the number of resources. And to do its task, each process needs access to multiple resources. So it needs to get multiple locks to do something. So in this backup example, you need a lock on the disk and the tape so you can actually just read from the disk all of the files and dump it to the tape. Okay, if you only have one lock or the other, you cannot do the task that you want. Okay, another good example is let's say travel reservation system. Okay, so suppose you want to book a trip. Okay, and so you want to make a hotel reservation, an airline reservation, and a car rental reservation. Okay, and if for any reason any of those things are not available, okay, then you don't want to go. So for example, if a hotel is available but maybe the air ticket that you want is not available, then your trip, the way you want it planned, is basically not working out. Okay. So what might happen is you might tell your online travel agent saying, book me a hotel on these dates, this is the air trip I want to fly from let's say New York to San Francisco or some such thing, and I want a car rental. Okay? Now each of these are independent reservation system. Okay? Each airline has its own reservation system. Each hotel has its own reservation system. Car rental companies have their own reservation system. So any online site, let's say Travelocity or Expedia, so what they have to do is they actually have to go to independent reservation system, grab a lock on each of these reservation systems, figure out whether the necessary reservation you want to make is actually available, whether this airline ticket is available and so on. So it's basically all or nothing. Okay, so you want to now grab multiple locks and so on. And there may be lots of users that are trying to make reservations on Expedia or Travelocity all at the same time. For each of these requests, there will be one thread in the system that's trying to process that request. And to figure out even availability, forget the reservation. You might just send off a query saying what are the ticket prices for flying from New York to San Francisco on this date. You have to actually grab a lock on the reservation system and get the pricing information and display. Okay. So here is an example where the online system has threads that needs to grab multiple locks at the same time. There are lots of these threads. Each one is servicing a user. Okay. Another example of the dining philosopher's problem that arises in practice. Okay. Is this clear? Some, just to give you some flavor of where all of these occur in practice. Okay. So keep that in mind. Yeah, now what we are going to do today is to talk about deadlock. Okay, I introduced this notion briefly last time when we were talking about solutions to dining philosophers. Okay, so there the specific example there was each philosopher just grabs the right left fork and then everyone is waiting for the right fork and nobody can make progress. That's a scenario called a deadlock, which we are going to look at in detail. Okay, so I will introduce formally what's a deadlock. Okay. We'll look at what are the conditions that must be true for deadlock to occur. Okay? And we'll talk about deadlock detection and deadlock prevention. Okay, what can a system do to avoid this problem? Okay. So, a deadlock essentially is a condition where two or more threads are waiting for an event to occur, and this event can only be generated by the same group of threads. Okay? Typically, the event that you are interested in is to grab a lock. This is the most simple example of an event, but deadlocks can occur if you are waiting for other types of events as well. Okay? So, in this context, the event is, so if you have two or more threads that are waiting for a lock, okay, and the lock is actually held by someone else in this group, and everyone is waiting on someone else, okay, for the lock, and then you have a deadlock. So, here is an example of two threads and some code where you actually get a lock on the printer, get a lock on the disk, and you're copying a file from the printer to the disk. Essentially, you're printing that file and you're releasing that lock. Okay? There are two processes that are doing the same thing. Okay? The only difference is the first process, process A, first gets a lock on the printer and then a lock on the disk. Okay? Process B tries to acquire the lock in the opposite order. It's looking for the disk first and this is going for the disk next. Okay? So the claim is this code can lead to a deadlock. Okay? Doesn't mean that every run of this code will lead to a deadlock. But if there is some run that can cause that condition to become true, then there is a deadlock. The simplest example is process A runs, okay, and it gets hold of the printer lock. Okay, and the context switch happens before it executes this statement. Okay, the process B runs and it gets the disk lock. Disk lock is still available at this point. Okay, so it gets the disk lock and then it tries to acquire the printer lock and it blocks because the printer is held by process A. Okay, so that process is blocked waiting on process B is blocked waiting for A. Then A runs again and then it tries to acquire the disk lock, which B has already acquired. Okay, so now A is waiting on B's lock, which is the printer lock, and B is waiting on the A's lock, which is a disk lock, and neither of them is going to make progress from this point on because they are waiting on each other and they are not releasing their own locks. Okay, so you will basically have a condition called a deadlock, okay, where no thread can make progress. Okay, is this clear? Simple example. Okay. So as I mentioned, it's not the case that every run of A and B will lead to a deadlock. So A could just run, get hold of both locks, do it, do whatever it needs to do and release the lock, and then B could run. It may just happen that they're scheduled in that order, and in that run there won't be any problem. But if there is any execution sequence where you can actually have this condition be true, then your code can lead to a deadlock. That's something to keep in mind. Okay. So terminology for this chapter. So deadlock is assumed to occur when several threads compete for a finite number of resources simultaneously. Okay, so the number of threads is typically either equal or greater than the number of resources. Okay. When we say deadlock prevention, so we mean techniques where we will actually check what requests for resources are being made and what is the availability and somehow prevent deadlock from happening. And we'll see how that can be done. Okay. Deadlock detection, on the other hand, does not do this check. Okay. So deadlock prevention algorithms check before you actually acquire a lock to say, if I give you this lock, can that lead to a deadlock? Okay. Deadlock avoidance, on the other hand, you don't do a check before the locks are acquired. You just let processes acquire whatever locks they want. But once you grant these locks, you check, could a deadlock have happened? Okay. If so, then you do something about it. You run deadlock termination. So deadlock detection algorithm find instances of deadlock after they occur and try to do something about it. Okay. So in this case, for example, you might actually let the processes run. Okay, if you are doing the second algorithm, which is deadlock detection, you will just let these processes run. And if it so happens that A ends up waiting on B and B ends up waiting on A, you detect that condition and say, I see that there is a deadlock here and I'm going to do something. And that might be you kill process A or you make it give up its lock or some such thing. Okay. In the previous, if you are actually running a deadlock prevention algorithm, okay, then what you would do in this case is you would let process A run and then it has a printer lock, and when B runs and you see what are the resources it wants to acquire, you don't even let it grab the first lock, saying if I do that then a deadlock may occur. So let process A run first and then I let process B run. So you prevent processes from acquiring locks in the first place. Okay, so question is, in the first case you actually do checks beforehand and avoid the problem altogether. In the second case, you detect when the problem occurs and try to fix it later. Okay, these are the two classes of techniques we are going to look at. Is this clear? What you can do about deadlocks? Either prevent it from happening altogether, okay, or you detect deadlocks after they occur and try to somehow fix the problem up later on. Okay. Now, the other important thing is to differentiate between deadlock and starvation. Okay. Starvation occurs when a thread waits for a very long period of time for some resource and other threads are actually making progress in the system. Okay. That condition is referred to starvation. So if you remember the CPU scheduling example, okay, like shortest job first, if there are always short jobs arriving into the system, a long job can be made to wait for a long period of time before it gets the CPU. That's, in other words, just starving a long job. That's not a deadlock. Okay. Even in case of starvation, some threads are going to wait for long or possibly indefinite amounts of time. Okay. But other threads are making progress. In a deadlock, you both have waiting and no progress. Okay. Everyone is waiting, nobody is making progress. That's a deadlock. If some threads are waiting but others are making progress, that is referred to starvation, but not deadlock. Okay. So it's very important to differentiate between when you have a condition that is starvation and when you actually have a deadlock. Okay? Is this clear? In both cases, both are bad because some threads are basically being made to wait forever. Okay? But one is worse condition to have than the other. Okay. So what are some conditions that are necessary for deadlock to occur? Okay, that doesn't mean it's sufficient, but they're necessary conditions. Okay, there are four conditions that need to be true. Okay, if a deadlock has occurred in the system, then all these four conditions would be true. Okay, the four conditions are: there's mutual exclusion, there's hold and wait in the system, there's no preemption, and there is a circular wait. Okay, let's look at each of this and try to understand what they mean. Okay? Mutual exclusion just says that there is a critical section somewhere in all of these programs, and at least one thread is holding a resource in non-shareable mode, in a mutually exclusive mode. By holding that resource, it is making someone else wait for that resource. Okay? So hold and wait says that at least one thread holds a resource and is waiting for another resource to become available. Okay? And there is some other thread that holds that resource. Okay? So you are holding some resources and waiting for some other resources. That has to be true, and that you will remember that in this simple example, A was holding the printer and waiting on the disk, B was holding the disk waiting on the printer. That's hold and wait. Okay? No preemption says that your system cannot force a thread or a process to voluntarily give up the resource. So it's if you could force a thread to give up the resource, then you can have deadlock prevention. But the assumption is if you have no preemption in the system. Once you get a resource, you have to give it up. So system cannot make you give it up. Okay? And then the last and most important condition is there is circular wait. Okay? Meaning that there is some sequence of threads, T1 through Tn, where T1 is waiting on T2, T2 is waiting on T3 and so on, and Tn is waiting on T1. So you have this circular wait which prevents anyone from making progress. Okay, so there's a loop, and that is the cause of the deadlock. Okay, so in the simple example here, you do have a circular wait. A waits on B and B waits on A. That's a cycle. Okay, so if you have this kind of a cycle, then you will not make progress because everyone is waiting for someone else in that cycle. Okay, so if all of so point is, if a deadlock has occurred in the system, then all of these conditions are true. Okay, in other words, they are necessary conditions. Okay, is everyone clear what a necessary condition is? Okay, it's not sufficient. Okay, just because all of these four are true doesn't mean a deadlock can occur. Okay, but if there is a deadlock, if I say there is a deadlock in the system, then all of these hold. Okay, meaning that it will be the case that there's mutual exclusion. So look at the previous example, right? So mutual exclusion, there's hold and wait, there is no preemption, and there's circular wait. Okay. So we'll look at deadlock detection first, okay, and then we are going to look at deadlock avoidance. Okay. So deadlock detection is very simple. So we are basically going to check for cycles and try to ensure that there aren't any. Okay. So to understand this notion of what a cycle is, we'll first define a graph. Okay. This graph has two types of nodes, a thread and a resource. Okay. And you will have an edge from a thread to a resource whenever that thread is waiting on that resource. You will have an edge from a resource to a thread if that resource is held by the thread. Okay. So here is a quick example. Okay, so the first one is called a request edge and the second one is called an assignment edge. So here is an example. Okay, so these are threads T1, T2, T3, T4, and the square boxes with labels R are resources. They could be printers, disks, locks, doesn't matter. Okay, so R1, R2, R3 and R4. Okay, so here is an edge from T2 to R1. That's the first type of edge. That says thread 2 has requested a lock on resource R1. Okay. And here is an edge from R1 to T3 that goes in the opposite direction. It goes from a resource to the thread. That basically says that this resource is being held by this thread. The lock on this resource is held by T3. T3 is requesting a lock on R2. The lock on R2 is currently held by T4. T4 is requesting a lock on R3 and that lock is held by T2. So you see that there is a cycle here. Okay. So this cycle is often the case why you have a deadlock in the system. That was the same thing that happened in that sample program I showed. Okay, there are two resources, there are printers and disk and two processes, and each one was holding one resource and waiting on the other. Okay, that led to a similar cycle. Okay, yes, question.
You mentioned deadlock recovery in the sense of deadlock recovery. Like, I get how you could sort of trivially find the deadlocks, but I don't see how I could arbitrarily know whether it's safe.
Yes, so we will talk about all that. We'll build up to that. Okay, so now if the graph has no cycles, it's guaranteed that there is no deadlock. Okay, is that clear? There is no circular weight. If the graph has no cycle, there is no circular weight. So there is no deadlock by definition. Okay? If graph has a cycle, a deadlock might exist. It doesn't mean that it's guaranteed that there's a deadlock, but there is. So I'll show you in the next slide where there is a cycle, but you can easily see that there is no deadlock in the system. Okay? So both of these you need to keep in mind. If there are no cycle, there is no deadlock, but if there is a cycle, there may be a deadlock. So might, but not necessary. So why is it the case that if a graph has a cycle, that there might be a deadlock, but it's not necessary that there is a deadlock? So the reason for this is you may have multiple instances of a resource, okay? And that's what is shown here, okay? And these are multiple interchangeable instances of a resource, okay? So if you have this, then a cycle is only indicative that the deadlock might exist, but doesn't necessarily guarantee. So here is an example, okay? So now each resource has multiple instances. So there's one instance of R1, one instance of R2, there are two instances of R3. Okay, there are two resources of type R3. When a process requests R3, it doesn't care whether it gets the first instance or the second instance, it just wants one of the two. Okay. Same with R4. Okay, there are three instances of R4. So think of this as, let's say, a printer. Okay. You want to print, and there's a bank of printers. Okay. It doesn't matter which of them prints your job. Okay. You just want the one of the printers to print. Okay, so it's those are interchangeable resources, so you can get access to any one of them. It doesn't matter to you which one. Okay, now here is an example again of a cycle. Okay, so R3, well, this instance of R3 is held by T2. T2 holds R1. T2 is requesting R1. R1 is held by T3, and you go this way. Okay, so that's basically a cycle. Okay, now the reason why cycles don't necessarily lead to a deadlock is basically shown in this second example. Okay. So what we have done here is, here there are only two instances of R3, but we added a new instance. So now R3 has three instances. Okay. And the first instance of R3 is actually held by T1. The second instance is held by T2, and the third instance is held by T3. Okay. So as is being mentioned there, if there is any instance of a resource that is held by a thread that is not in the cycle, then when that thread releases that resource, you can still make progress. Okay. So here is an example. You have the circular weight here. Okay. And here is T1 that's not part of the cycle. This thread is actually holding R3. Okay. At some point in time, let's say T1 is done with R3 and it releases it. Okay. Now you can start making progress. Okay. Because one instance of R3 has been freed up, you can immediately give it to one of these threads that's waiting on it. T4 is waiting on R3. So you can give this instance that has been freed up to T4, and now there is no longer a cycle in the graph. Okay. Everyone can make progress, because eventually T4 will be done with R3, it will release R3, okay, and so on, and then the cycle will basically disappear. Okay. So when you have multiple instances of a resource and there is at least one thread, okay, that is not in the cycle that's holding an instance, then you can have a cycle, but it's possible to break that cycle. There's a possible execution sequence where everyone's requests for locks will get satisfied, and there will be no longer a hold and wait or a circular wait in the system. Okay. Yes.
So if you don't have
right. So if you have this, then this is a deadlock. There's nothing you can do. Yes. Like in this code, right? It's one disk and one printer. Your circular weight, that's guaranteed to be a deadlock. Okay. So if you have only one instance, then a cycle is indicative of a deadlock. You can't say it might exist. There is a deadlock for sure. Okay. But if you have multiple instances, you have this example where I just showed you that you can actually get rid of the deadlock. Even though there is a cycle in the graph, you don't have a deadlock situation. But if you have only one instance, then you do. Okay, yes.
Is there a sense of what conservative deadlock detection is sort of?
Yes, so I'll talk about how to do deadlock detection. Okay, just one second. Is this clear? Okay. So how do you now detect deadlocks? And how do you correct for it? Okay. So one thing you could do is just prevent cycles from occurring altogether. Okay? Every time you do a lock acquire, you keep maintain this graph in the system. The operating system could actually keep track of every lock, okay, and every thread that either holds or requests locks. And at some point in time, there may be some graph that you have in the system that shows who has held locks and who is requesting locks. So whenever a new lock acquire request arrives, so let's say you do L1 dot acquire, you check what happens if you add that edge to this graph. Will that result in a cycle or not? Okay, so you say thread T1 has requested L1 or something like that. So, okay, if you grant this resource, okay, then you actually have that edge. Okay, you say if I add this edge, will that result in a cycle? If the answer is no, go ahead and let the lock be acquired if it's available. Okay, if not, then you don't grant that request. Okay, that says that there will be a cycle, so you don't want to do it. Okay, that's one way to do it. So the other way is you don't worry about it, you don't check a priori. Okay, because I said the fact that you have a cycle is not indicative of a deadlock. Okay, just because I showed you there could be multiple instances. So you don't do this a priori, you do this later. If you see that threads have stopped making progress, then you try to see it, have any cycles formed, and you try to break that cycle. That's the algorithm shown here. Okay. So different ways. So scan the resource allocation graph for the cycles and break those cycles. So what you will do is you will see that maybe there is no progress. So you will scan and say, okay, now I do see a cycle, so this may be indicative of a deadlock. So I can do one of those things. You can kill all the threads in the cycle. Okay. You could kill the threads one at a time, okay, and is assume that when you kill a thread, it actually gives up the resource. Okay. Or you preempt or you take back the resource forcibly. Okay, so that's preemption. So you roll it back, saying that I'm going to take the resource away from you because there is a cycle, I need to break it. So you roll back and you retry the acquire. So you undo everything you did in your critical section, you roll back and you restart. So this is the technique that is used in database transactions. Okay, there's a notion of a transaction being aborted. Okay, so you have grabbed a lock, you have made some updates in your critical section, and you can be forced to undo all of those updates. The transaction aborts, everything that you did you undo and you go back to the lock acquire and you have to redo all of that code. This is called aborting a transaction. So that's what this technique is actually used in databases. Okay. The other two are typically not used. You don't go and start killing processes. Yes, the operating system doesn't tend to do that. Okay. Now detecting, so the question is now you have to come up with a Okay, so in this course, we will not define what a transaction is. If you haven't actually taken a database course, I'm going to just give you an idea of what a transaction is, but not necessarily go into details because that's left for a database class. So what is a transaction? So transaction is basically, think of it as a critical section and that is surrounded by begin and end transaction, and this whole piece of code executes as one atomic unit, meaning that everything in that way that's surrounded by the begin and end transaction executes or none of it executes. Okay, that's what an atomic unit is. Okay, this could be an arbitrary piece of code. So it is not only a critical section, it's a critical section that executes atomically. Okay, if you do any database programming, then either there's transactions that are being used by the database engine under the hood, or you are actually have written code that explicitly use transactions. So where are things like this used? So assume that you go to Amazon or you go to eBay and you try to buy something. Okay. So the last step where you are making a payment is typically handled as a transaction. Okay. So you send in your credit card number. Okay. And then either your credit card is billed or not billed. If your credit card that's called a transaction, either that goes through successfully and your credit card is charged, or it returns an error saying I couldn't do something failed. Okay, either you put in the wrong credit card number, you didn't have the credit limit, credit card system didn't work, okay, something is down, so nothing bad will happen. Okay, it won't be the case that half something went through halfway and then it stopped. Okay? Either the credit card was charged or not charged. So that's a large piece of code, if you think about it. Okay, so Amazon has to go to either Visa or MasterCard's processing system, first authenticate your credit card. Is this even valid? Okay, and maybe they'll even authenticate you against your address to make sure that somebody is doing a fraudulent transaction. And then once they've authenticated, then they're going to make a request to charge your card with some amount. And if that succeeds, then everything has succeeded. If anything fails, then everything is rolled back and you just get an error saying didn't work. Okay? That's just an example of a whole bunch of these operations that are executing as a single atomic unit. And that's the reason any database engine will support this. Okay? Now, the issue is whenever you have transactions, so the transaction actually ends up acquiring locks. So here is where you do a lock acquire and here is where you do lock release. So the same thing happens when you try to book a ticket on an airline. Okay? The reason you need to grab the lock is that there may be one seat left on the plane, okay, and two passengers or two prospective passengers may be both trying to book a seat and grab that one seat. You can't have a case where both of them are allocated that seat. Okay, only one has to be given that. So you have to first grab a lock on that airline database. Okay, and whichever one grabs the lock first essentially gets the last seat, and the next one, when they try, you get an error saying there are no seats left or something like that. Okay, in theory. But you are typically, airlines will overbook you anyway and then offload you later. Okay, but anyway, so those are all transactions. They have to happen atomically. There have to be locks that are granted, and you have to check, and databases will check if there are cycles and so on, and abort transactions if necessary. Okay, so anyway, that's a digression on transactions. That's not part of this course. But what we do want to understand is what is it that we have to do to detect these cycles. Okay, so you have cycle detection algorithms. Okay, and they typically take order n square time. If you have n nodes in the graph, okay, you want to see if there is a cycle, and these algorithms have order n square, meaning that the running time is proportional to square of the number of nodes in the graph. Okay, and that can be expensive. If you have, the graph is large, meaning that there are lots of threads and lots of resources, you will take n square time, order n square running time. Every time you do a lock acquire, you have to actually do this check. Okay, so the question is, when would you do it? Just before granting a resource, you can check this. Okay, so every lock acquire request then becomes order, has an order n square running time. Okay, it's not just checking whether this lock is available. Typically, lock acquire only checks whether this lock is available, and if so, you get the lock. Okay? Here we are saying not only should the lock be available, go and do this check against all of the resources in the system and see if getting the lock will lead to a cycle. Okay? So lock acquire then becomes a lot more expensive. You are not only checking locally about this log, you are checking about everything else in the system. Okay? So this may be expensive to do. It's typically not done, okay? But it could be done. The other place you could do this is when you try to do an acquire, but you don't get the log. Okay? Then you actually add an edge saying, now I'm waiting on this resource, and see if that leads to a cycle. Okay? So only if you do these checks on whether there is a cycle, only when the request fails, not when you grant it. Okay? And here are two other things you could think about. So you run this algorithm regularly, once an hour. Okay, so if there's a deadlock, the maximum wait time is an hour, and then you'll start breaking some edges, okay, by terminating the transactions or killing threads. But this may take a long time. It depends on how regularly you check. You could also see if the utilization of your system has dropped, okay, and then you trigger the cycle detection algorithm. If there's a hold and wait, and threads are not making any progress, everybody is just blocked, okay, your utilization is going to drop. Okay, so you could use this as a heuristic to say this is when I'm going to run the cycle detector to see if there is some problem in the system, and then try to correct it. Again, that may take a long time. Okay, low utilization is not necessarily indicative of a deadlock. It may just mean that there are no requests in the system. Okay, it's like if you are if you run a website, in the night times your load is going to be low, utilization is going to be low because there is not as many requests. During the day your website is more heavily loaded. Okay, so it doesn't mean that in the night the utilization drops, so there's a deadlock necessarily. Okay, so this is at best a hint or a heuristic, not a necessarily a good condition that should trigger cycle detection. Check whether there are cycles. Okay. So, what we talked about in this previous slide is to try to detect whether there is a deadlock and somehow break the deadlock. Okay, so you are checking for bad things that have already happened and trying to fix it at a later point. Okay. Question is, can you prevent deadlocks from happening altogether? So you don't have to check for it at a later time. What can you do to guarantee that you will never have a deadlock to begin with? Okay, if you do this, then you don't need any deadlock detectors or deadlock termination algorithms. So how would you go about doing this? How would you do deadlock prevention? Conceptually, not sort of low level details. Conceptually, what would you have to do to ensure deadlock prevention? To guarantee that your system will never have deadlocks to begin with. Deadlock free system. Yes.
Make your locks line up so that, you know, if you want to call multiple resources, you always have to do it the same way.
Okay. So
you can't have inconsistent dependencies.
Okay.
Because like if there's two resources A, B, you always gotta lock A before B. If another process tries to lock, you know, B, it's still, and it won't have anything to do with A, it's still gonna do A, B, so it's gonna prevent that inversion that causes the deadlock.
Right.
And it should prevent it across extended chains.
Okay, so impose ordering in which locks are required. Yes, you have something. Okay. So that's a valid point, but more generally what we are trying to say is if you want to prevent deadlock, you have to put some restrictions on your system. You can't let threads run around trying to grab locks in whatever order they want and then you get into trouble. Okay? So any deadlock prevention algorithm will impose some restriction. These could be severe restrictions, okay, in some cases, as we will see. Okay? But if you impose this restriction, say you cannot do these some things, other things are allowed but certain things are not allowed. Okay, what was pointed out here is you are imposing a restriction on the order in which locks are required. Okay, and you have to respect those that restriction, otherwise problems can occur. Okay? So any deadlock prevention algorithm is going to impose restriction. What this slide is showing is what are some types of restrictions you can impose. Okay? So now let's think more generally about what are the restrictions you can impose. Okay, and so to do this, we will actually go back to our necessary conditions. Okay? Because these are necessary conditions, if you ensure that one of them, any one of those conditions is never going to be true in practice, then it's guaranteed that your system will not have will never have a deadlock. Okay, is this clear? Because very simply this just follows from elementary logic, because this says deadlock implies that four conditions are true. Okay. So not of this should imply no deadlock. So if this is negated, that implies no deadlock. Because A implies B, not B implies not A. Okay? So if one of these conditions is always false in your system, meaning you impose a restriction such that one of this can never occur in your system, then it's guaranteed that your system will not have any deadlock. Okay? So you have to now impose a restriction, you pick whichever condition you want and you make that always be false. Okay? Do something in the system so that will never be true and then you will not have deadlock. First one is trivial. First one says there should be mutual exclusion. So if you say get rid of all locks, there will never be any critical sections in my system. Okay, trivially there is no deadlock. If you say I will never allow anyone to get any locks, I will just eliminate the whole concept of a lock. Okay, if you don't have locks, there is no synchronization and there is no deadlock, as you can see. Rather severe restriction, meaning you will never have any never be able to do any synchronization, but you also don't have any deadlocks. Okay? So that's not necessarily a good restriction to impose. But you can see why I'm saying if any of those become false, then you will basically ensure that you don't have a deadlock. Okay? So as I said, first one says no mutual exclusion in my system. That basically says that all resources are shareable and there are no locks to protect them. Okay? Not necessarily a good thing. Okay? So that's not what you really want. Okay? You can say, I will ensure that hold and wait will never occur in my system. The way you do this is to basically guarantee that a thread cannot hold more than one resource when it requests the other. Okay, what does hold and wait mean? I hold one and I wait on something else. So you say if you are holding something, you cannot request anything else. You first release that and then request something else. So then you have no hold and wait. You only hold. You can never wait. You hold, release, and then you try to hold something else. Again, not a good scenario, because if you need mutually exclusive access to multiple resources, you need to hold multiple locks. Okay? This is saying you can only hold one lock at a time and never more than one lock. Okay? Yes?
Shouldn't we solve that problem with the hungry philosopher problem, or the dying philosopher? So, if we just... Because the hold and wait, it seems like the dying philosopher is the only condition in which that all happens. So it's already solved.
Actually, in dining philosopher, you had these two problems. There was hold and wait. There was also circular wait. You had held the left chopstick. You were all waiting on the right, and everyone was waiting. So this was the condition that we actually eliminated. That also eliminated that. But I mean, you had both. In fact, actually all four were true, because if you have a deadlock, then all four are true. Okay. So here, so another first one says no locks, we don't like that. This one says only one lock at a time. Okay. So if you only hold one lock, you can only hold or you can wait. You cannot do both. Okay. Either you hold a lock or you are waiting on a lock. But you cannot hold more than one lock, so you can't hold one lock and wait on the other. Okay. Again, that doesn't quite work when you have multiple resources. So the tape backup example, you actually need a lock on the tape and the disk. You can't say you only get the lock on the disk and forget the tape. Something else may start writing to the tape and corrupt what you're writing. Okay? So again, a severe condition or a severe restriction rather that you don't necessarily want in practice. But if you impose that restriction, okay, suppose you're writing a program, you could get away by saying a thread can only hold one lock at a time. You'll write the code such that that's true. It's guaranteed you will not have a deadlock. If a thread doesn't, if your program doesn't have any locks, you don't worry about deadlocks. Okay, same thing. Okay. So you can again say, the no preemption condition can be falsified. Okay, meaning that after a thread acquires a lock, I can force it to give up a lock. Okay, so you can preempt resources. If you could preempt resources, the system can forcibly take the lock away from you, then also you can get rid of deadlocks, because any cycle can be trivially broken by forcing some thread to give up a lock, and then there is no cycle. Okay, one edge is gone from the graph. Okay, if I take away a lock, then you just take one of that edge away and the cycle is broken, and then everything is fine. Okay. Again, you don't want that necessarily, because if you write code and you basically see that a thread has gotten hold of a lock, suddenly the lock may be gone and your thread is doing something. Okay, that basically introduces some non-determinism in your code. You are expecting that the lock is held until you release it, and yet the system just took it away from you. Okay? Only in certain restricted scenarios should this be even allowed. Okay, so again, a fairly stringent condition. Okay? And there are some things like some resources where you may not even want to do preemption. Okay, I hold a printer, I'm printing. Okay, let's say I have printed 50 of my 100 pages. Okay, and I take the printer away from whoever is printing. Okay, you wasted 50 pages and the job didn't finish. Not a good example of preemption. Okay, so you don't want to necessarily preempt certain resources. Okay, so typically what you would do is to try to eliminate the last condition. Okay, because this is not necessarily a severe restriction. All the other first three, if you try to make them false in your system, you end up with some severe restriction. So what you will do here is that you will impose an ordering on the numbering of resources and request them in that order. Okay, so you will never have hold and you will never have a circular weight. Okay, so let me just try to, I'll show you how this works, but let me show you what that means. Okay. So in this particular piece of code, if I actually flip these two instructions, okay, I do the printer lock first before doing the disk lock, and this also does the printer lock first and then does the disk lock, you can guarantee that there is no hold and wait, or rather there is no circular wait. Is this clear why? In other words, if B did the same thing that A is doing, I claim that there will not be a deadlock. There can never be a deadlock, more precisely. Why is that?
Because if A's process of holding the lock, the printer lock, prevents B's process of getting to the disk, ensures that you have the disk available to acquire, since the only other process is blocked at its first line.
Right. So if B first tries to get the printer lock before getting the disk lock, what is going to happen is if A runs first, it gets the printer lock. Okay, and B will, whenever it runs, it will act, if A has acquired the printer lock, B just blocks on the printer lock. It never gets the disk lock. Okay, so A is guaranteed to make progress because there is no circular wait in the system. Okay, B is just waiting on A. A is not going to wait on B because A can go and get the disk lock. So what you have done is you have imposed an ordering in which locks can acquire. This was the same point that was mentioned some time back. Okay. If you impose an ordering, say any process, so what you will do essentially is that, let's say you globally number all locks. Okay. So you will say L1, L2, L3, LN. Okay. If you need any subset of these locks, okay, then you always have to acquire them in that order. So if I need L2 and L4, I should always request L2 before I request L4. Okay? I can never request a higher numbered lock before requesting a lower numbered lock. Okay? If you impose this restriction, then there will not be a circular wait. Okay? Is that clear why? Okay? Because edges can only go that way. Edge can never go back. The edge cannot go back, then there cannot be a cycle. Cycle by definition requires an edge that goes that way. So there is a loop. Okay? If you only request in that order, you can at most have edges that are going this way, but never an edge that comes back. Okay? Because you are always acquiring in that order. You cannot loop back and go this way. Okay? So in this case, you had printer and disk. So you had L1 and L2. One guy went for L1 first and one went for L2. So you got a loop like that. So that's why there was a circular wait. Okay. But if both of them actually went in that order, then one of them got blocked here, the other one is making progress, and then it will release the lock and the next one will actually go down the chain acquiring the same set of locks. Okay, yes.
If the strategy is being used and say one process tries to abuse it, what would be like the runtime to check? Because like you could just look at that process's sequence of locks and be like, I think I want to say it would be later, I'm not sure.
Right. So you are asking what if some process refuses to do this, mm-hmm. Right?
Like it goes L4, L2.
Yes. So if process refuses to do this, then you are going to have a deadlock, unless you check for this.
Right.
Either the system has to check that I impose this ordering, you have already acquired L4, so you cannot request from this point on any locks L1 through L3. Is there a runtime check? So the simple answer is there is no runtime check. Okay. Typically, this is better done by programmers. So if you have you are writing a program, okay, you actually logically impose an ordering.
My question is the runtime check improved at all?
There is no runtime that checks it.
I'm saying if there is one.
The runtime is trivial, right? Why? What do you mean improved? Runtime just says that when you have locks, you will have ordering. What is there to check?
When you check the detection, when the algorithm, if you had an algorithm go through and try to successfully detect before it added the lock, and it checked the ordering.
There is no link detection here. That's what I'm trying to say. The check is simple, very trivial. The check says what is the lock that you are currently requesting, and then if you ever request any I that is less than j, you would say that you have violated the check. Yes, it's basically a, so this is not a cycle detector here. That's what I was trying to say. Okay, any other questions? Is this clear why this will not result in a loop? That if you impose this ordering, you will not have this cycle ever occur in your system. Okay. Again, you don't have to detect cycles, because if you actually had a runtime system that just imposes an ordering, it's basically a simple check which says if you have ever held lock k, you can never request any I that is greater than k. So if you do that, you just say you violated this check. Okay, if you wanted to do that check. Okay. So here is a slightly more sophisticated technique that does something like this. Okay. So what we will do is we will define a sequence of threads to be safe or unsafe. Okay, the sequence of threads is said to be safe if Ti can still make a request such that all of the available resources currently available, as well as resources held by threads that are strictly have IDs that are strictly less than I, can satisfy that resource. Okay, I will give you an example of what a safe state is. Okay. If you have that condition be true, then this state is said to be safe. Okay. An unsafe state is not equivalent to deadlock, as you will see, but it could lead to a deadlock. Okay. Now, why are we saying this as opposed to doing this check? This is a generalization of this simple example where you could have multiple instances of a resource. Okay. If you had multiple instances, then the runtime is actually more complicated. You have to do this. If you have one instance of each resource, then it's a trivial check. Okay. This is a more complicated check. So let me show you an example. Okay, so basically the idea is you grant a resource to a thread if the new state that you transition into is safe. Okay, here is. Okay, so here is an example of three threads, T1, T2, T3, and there are 12 tape drives in the system. Okay, threads can request some number of tape drives. Assume that these are backup processes. Okay, let's say you are doing a backup in large company. Okay. Typically, you have what are called enterprise storage systems that are your hundreds or thousands of disks in your large data center, and you have lots of tape drives. And there are not one backup process, but multiple backup processing all running at the same time. Each one is just trying to grab some number of tapes and dump its data. Okay, so that's the example. Okay, now this is the current state of the system. Okay, each thread has declared what is the maximum number of tape drives it can ask for simultaneously or concurrently, and then there is some number of tape drives that are in use. Okay, so we can check at any point. Okay, what would happen if a thread asks for some more tape drive? Will that result in a safe state or not a safe state? Okay, so the claim is this current status is safe. Okay, T1 needs for up to 4, currently has asked for, currently holds 3 of these tape drives. T2 can ask up to 8, it basically has holds 4. T3 can ask for all 12 if it wants, and it's currently holding 4. Okay, this says how many more could it request. So it can ask for one more, that's 4 minus 3, can ask for 4, this can ask for 8. Okay, now let's assume that you ask for some more. Okay, so the question is, will that result? So how many of them are in use? Right now there are 11 in use. Okay, so because each, this has gotten 3, this has gotten 4, and this has gotten 4, you have 12 tape drives. There's one tape drive that no one is using. Okay, and if this is safe, now assume that any of the, let's suppose that T1 requests one more tape drive. Question is, will that result in a safe or a not safe state? The claim is it will be safe, because what will happen is that you are asked for the maximum, you cannot ask for any more than that. It is assumed that at some point you will finish and release all of your maximum. Okay, so you have asked for this one, now you hold 4. Okay, and if T2 and T3 ask for anything at some this point, they have to wait, because all of the 12 are in use. but it is assumed that T1 will finish, it will release its 4 tapes. Okay? If T2 now asks for the maximum, those 4 could be granted to this. Okay? So then it holds its 8 tapes, it will finish at some point, it will release all of its 8, and then those could be given to T3, and T3 will run and finish. Okay? Now here is an example, the same example with small modification. Okay? Says that this is not a safe state. The only thing that has changed from the previous slide is that rather than holding 4, T3 now holds 5 tape drives. Okay? And everything else is the same. T1 is holding 3, T2 is holding 4, T3 is holding 5. So all 12 are in use at this point. Okay? So now question is, if T3 requests one more tape drive, should we grant that request or not grant that request? Okay. So you would basically say that you don't want to grant that request because doing that will lead to an unsafe state. Okay. Because you could ask for, you can ask for 12, you already hold 5. If you ask for one more, okay, T1 also could ask for one more and T2 could also ask for one more and you will all be blocked because all of them are in use. Everyone is asked for one more at this point. And that leads to an unsafe state because all T1 is waiting for one, T2 is waiting, and you will not release because you are all blocked waiting for this one more tape drive to become available. Okay? So if you are in this state, then you cannot let T3 ask for one more. So if the request one more acquire request comes, you will actually deny that acquire request. Okay. Now what you have effectively done here is actually it's a generalization of this very simple idea, because this will lead to a circular wait, because T3 will wait for T1, T1 will wait for T2, T2 will wait, so you have this wait where everyone is waiting for someone else to release one more tape drive so they can make progress. Okay? So that's a state you don't want to get into because there you will have circular wait. Okay? So essentially what this algorithm is doing is it looking at what is the request that you have made, will that result in a circular wait? Okay, and the answer is from this state you can actually go into a circular wait state, so you will never try to go into transition to that state. You will actually deny that request, saying I cannot give you that I cannot put you on wait for that acquire request. Okay, so that's an example of an unsafe state. This is an example of a safe state because here you could let each one of them make one more request and you will still be okay. Okay. So if all of them ask for one more tape drive, you could first let T1 go. It gets its full allocation, it finishes, then it releases all 4, then T2 goes next and so on and so forth. Okay, but not from the second example. Okay. So that's a more sophisticated deadlock prevention algorithm that uses this notion of resource reservation. Okay, resource reservation says that threads tell you in advance about the maximum number of resources they may need during execution. So this has to be declared by these threads ahead of time. It says I can ask for a maximum of these many resources. So you declare this. System keeps track of this information. As each request comes in, it checks saying are you going to go put the system into a safe or an unsafe state. If you go into an unsafe state, then that request is denied. If you basically only allow transitions from one safe state to another. And if you do this, then I think you can claim or prove rather that you will never have deadlocks in the system. Okay. So this is something that's a little involved to understand as to why there can be circular state. So I would encourage you to go back and look at this example. Just do a paper and pencil thing to make understand what I said here. If you have any questions, we can come back to it next time. Okay, we'll talk about a more sophisticated algorithm also called the Banker's algorithm next time. That also does deadlock prevention. Okay. So quick recap. So just the take home is deadlock is a situation where threads and processes cannot make progress. Okay, there is no progress in the system and you are waiting for a resource that is held by another member in the group. Okay. So there are many ways to handle deadlocks. Okay. One is to check for deadlock after it has occurred and break it. Okay. The other is to impose some restrictions on the system so you don't even get into a deadlock. So we looked at both types of techniques. okay, the deadlock prevention and deadlock detection and recovery. Okay, so the basic under, so although most systems will never do any of this, okay, so there's no operating system that actually implements either deadlock detection and recovery or deadlock prevention, but these techniques are useful for you to write multi-threaded programs. Okay, when you write threaded programs and when you have locks, these are the principles you should use to ensure that no deadlock will occur. You typically want to deadlock detection and recovery. Okay, that basically says you manually killed your program. That you don't want to do. Okay, because there is no other way to do it. So what you do want to do is to essentially ensure that some of these conditions, one of these conditions will not occur. Okay. Typically that means this one, okay, because you don't want to do this. Okay. That is a restriction that says I can only hold one lock at a time. If your application is simple enough to do that, then that's fine. And typically you do want mutual exclusion. So this is the one that you typically want to avoid. And that can be done by imposing an ordering, okay, on the resources and request them in that order. This is the simplest principle to use in a multi-threaded program to avoid deadlocks altogether. Okay, so you number, logically number all the locks. Okay, ensure that if any thread wants multiple locks, it actually acquires them in increasing order. Okay, if you do the simple thing, then you will ensure that your program will not have deadlock. If not, you will have that condition that we just showed in this very trivial program that violates that condition and you get into a deadlock. Okay, so that is the thing to keep in mind. Although operating systems or any other system don't necessarily use these ideas, they apply directly to any multi-threaded programs you write. Okay, so ensure that you follow these principles and you will not get into problems with deadlock. Okay, so we will stop here for today. Yeah, I believe Tuesday there is no class because it's a virtual Monday. Okay, so we will actually meet a week from, well, you will actually come to the discussion on Wednesday, but the next lecture will be a week from today. Okay?